Succession number 9876, reel 5.
On a troop ship.
On a troop ship at Southampton, with the men I was taking out to France, my own men, and a large number of other reinforcements for infantry and all arms. And they packed them tight on this ship. So tight that they couldn't lie down or anything. They were jammed in. And I was, of course, everybody very young and inexperienced was naturally immediately caught by the authorities and made officer of the ship. Not because they thought I'd be any good in that capacity, but because it was a nasty job and the youngest chap had to do it usually. And so I was officer of the ship. And we had a very bad crossing. And I thought to myself, if you're officer of the ship, you better go down to the lower deck and see what's happened to the troops there. And I found the troops in a little bit deplorable condition on the lower deck because it was very rough and they had no room to be sick in between each other, and so they were sick on each other, and it was a pretty evil sight, and I couldn't do a thing to help them. So we were disembarked in the morning at Le Havre, and we had a long march to a base camp called, I think, Saint-Martin. Well, I don't say that because I don't know, but a base camp. And so I took my chaps, and I think I was still technically in command of the other people on the ship, but anyway, we all got to the base camp, and we were given our billets in Essen Hut. And I was pounced upon and made orderly officer. That was it seemed inevitable to me. But nothing seemed to happen. A day went by and another day went by, and I still wasn't getting any orders. And I thought to myself, I must try and move something. So what I did was to, as ordinary officer, I had to inspect the men's meals. Well, they were dreadful. That was always the way with a big base camp. The bigger the unit, the worse the conditions, always. So I put in a report. I was supposed to put in a report saying that the meal was satisfactory, and so I put in a report saying it was deplorable, which it was. I thought that this would probably mean that I'd get labelled as a nuisance and sent up the line, which was the object, and so I was with my chaps. I don't know that the things were connected, really. It was a try-on. But anyway, I got up the line, and I was in the train on the way to the front. And there, an older subaltern in the carriage with me, who'd been out for quite a long time, was coming back from leave. He said to me, "Is it your first time out?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, I think you're rather lucky. The line's extremely quiet, except just for the Ypres salient, and that's hell on earth." And And then a messenger came along and gave me a slip of paper with an orders to report at the railhead at Popery. And I knew that I knew where I was going. And this was, of course, this was in August.
1917. Had you been assigned to a battery yet, or was that when you got the news that this, you're...
No, when I was in the train, I was assigned to a battery. I was told to report to 212 siege battery, a Popperin. I got me, my chaps off the train at Popperin. I was met by the sergeant major of 212, who was extremely welcoming and said they were very glad to get some more chaps in, and he would take me in the sidecar, battery motorcycle and sidecar. He would take me to the battery's billets. Billets suggests that you are living with civilians somewhere, but you're not. All billets mean in the artillery, or meant in the First World War, was that there were places where you rested, some way behind the battery position, and out of the, a little bit out of the fire. And so we came along, and there was a huge bank, and there were a lot of holes that had been dug in this bank, an elephant iron put in them, semicircular elephant iron, and that was where they were living. And the sergeant major said to me, "Well, I'm very sorry, sir, but they didn't tell us you were coming today, so we weren't able to get a place ready for you. Would you mind occupying this hole here? The corporal it belongs to has gone on leave." So I crawled into the hole vacated by the corporal on leave and spent a night. And next morning, the sergeant major said to me, "Well, I think so. If I may suggest it, you'd better take your men and dig yourself a dugout. You don't want to be saddled with this one all the time." And so I took my men. We started to dig a hole for me, and there were shells bursting. And I hadn't the least idea whether they were lethal or not. I could hear a roar and a burst of mud and smoke and fumes and so on. But whether they were going to do us any harm or not, I didn't know. And of course, none of the men with me, and none of whom had been out before, knew either. So we hoped we weren't going to be hit. I later discovered they were miles away. There was no possible harm. However, having done that in the early morning...
What was the dugout like, you dug?
It was just a roof of elephant iron like
is,
this.
Is that like corrugated iron?
Yeah, corrugated iron. In troughs, you know, like this. It'll hold up there above and underneath. You put some sandbags usually to act as pillars for it, and on the floor you put duck boards, which are.
And about how big would the total enclosed space be?
About a third of this room, I think.
So about 4 foot wide.
Yes, about 4 foot wide and. 8 foot deep.
And how many people would sleep in that?
Only me.
That was just for you?
Only me.
Did you have anything else in there?
No. Only, we used to have a sort of trestle that you could have a stretcher on it, or you could have, if you could get hold of some netting, some rabbit wire, you could make us of a rough bed. And I certainly had one.
Now, you just reached, what was, you joined the 212 battery. What was the organisation of the battery? How was it organised and what was its establishment?
The battery had a commanding officer who was a major. Actually, he was a regular major. Been to Woolwich. They had on their books a captain, a second in command, but he was hardly ever there. He was always inclined to be away on courses and so on. And then they had about, I should suppose, 6 or 7 subalterns. Who shared out the each really looked after the men belonging to one of the guns. Then of course there were other men not on any particular gun doing jobs in the battery position and that, but that was the arrangement. Now the awkward thing really could have been this: that I had been commissioned such a long time in England that I was a first lieutenant. And these chaps who had every sort of battle experience were still second lieutenants, and they were much older than me. And they had every excuse for resenting it very much, I think. But far from it, they were all quite delightful. When I reported to the major, he was very pleasant, not the sort of commanding officer I was used to at all. And he said to me, "Well, you'll have been taught all sorts of things in the cadet school in England. All I say to you now is don't forget the whole thing. You will learn here how to do your job. They can't tell you at home." And, well, he became one of my principal friends, this chap. But he was one of these people whom the cliché is that they didn't know what fear was. Well, he did, actually, but he was appallingly given to the pursuit of danger. Particularly, he wanted to get the best possible effects out of the battery, and that used to lead him to the worst possible places on the front line, because you'd get the best view from them.
What was his name?
Evans, an Irishman. Eric Evans. He was very young. I think he was only about 25. And very efficient indeed, and disconcertingly brave. Well, disconcertingly, particularly for me, because as I was the senior person, technically, in the absence of any captain, he used to like to take me with him on his forays in the front line. And I was continually finding myself in positions that I would have avoided like the plague if I hadn't been with him. On this occasion, when I had arrived, he said to me, "You must be terribly anxious to go and see the front line. It really is most interesting." Well, I thought to myself, you know, qualified enthusiasm as far as I'm concerned, but still, he called another chap who I also became a great friend of, another subaltern, and said, "Take Dennis up and show him the front line." So we went off, and then I got my first lesson in shell dodging, because a couple of field gun shells went off, as I thought, terribly close, though I don't think they were really. But we threw ourselves on the ground in time and nothing happened. And I learned that the technique which was really very, very important for everybody, which was what you did when you heard a shell. Down on your face, no matter where you are, and no matter what the result of filth so on may be. I think I ought to say something general here, because it's rather important. This was, of course, a very good battery and a very happy one. But it was not, I think, unique. All the others I've visited seem to be the same, in the sense that all the kind of unpleasantness which is common in military life at home, all the kind of chaps checking chaps for doing the wrong thing or not doing the right thing, putting gunners on a charge because they did something wrong, all this kind of atmosphere was completely lacking. We never had a man on a charge, except I remember there was one exception, I think, but only one I can remember, and there was a sort of instinctive, I suppose it was chaps all in the same situation, which is a dangerous situation. I suppose they don't feel the same towards one another as people in the army and peace in England. But at any rate, I was intensely conscious of the fact that I was going to see the gun crew on number three. When I got into the gun pit, I would be welcomed. Nobody would expect me to start off by putting somebody on a charge for having an undone bootlace or something like this. I think that of course some of this was due to the atmosphere that the commanding officer spread around the place, and to the fact that the subalterns were like that. They were a very varied lot. The one who took me to the front line first was in peacetime, a master at a co-educational school, a most rare thing in those days. He was a chap who, far from not knowing what fear was, never knew very well what fear was, and I used to think that I could hear his teeth chattering, but it never prevented him doing appallingly dangerous things, like crawling out on his belly into no man's land because he wanted to get a view of a part of the German line we were going to shell. I mean, he did all that kind of thing. He wasn't what I, as a public school boy, had been led to believe would be the sort of chap who'd be a master at a co-educational school where they had girls.
Are there any other officers you can bring?
Then there was a Welshman. Every good battery ought to have a Welshman, because it's a fount of good body humour. He was a scion of a family that had published, I think, the hymns of Moody and Sankey. But you'd never have known it. He kept things continually bubbling. And then a charming person, all these were older than me, a farmer's son from Wiltshire, another farmer who'd done his farming in Canada and had come over and enlisted, who was far too old. He ought to have been at home, but they all did their job very well. And then we may have had one or two others, but I can't remember them. I think we may have had a couple of other subalterns. But the whole atmosphere was pleasant.
How about
Sorry, carry on.
And when I visited the other batteries in the brigade, it seemed to me that their atmosphere was usually the same.
How about the NCOs? You mentioned the Sergeant Major.
Oh, the NCOs, of course, they were not mostly regulars. The Sergeant Major, I think he was. But the NCOs were chaps who had been promoted. Well, like when I got my lot in Liverpool, I had no NCOs, and I had to look about and see what chaps looked as if they were NCOs and make them corporals. The NCOs were also very, very much they were not feared or disliked by the men in any way, as far as I know. We had a very good corporal of signals who was killed in a regrettable shell fire one night. It really was such a difference to military life in England. And another thing that I noticed, which was I noticed with surprise and quite a lot of delight, that nobody minded admitting they were frightened. It wasn't against you. A chap used to come into the headquarters dugout, say, "My God, I nearly peed my bags out there. I very nearly got had by a German 5.9 house shell." There was no pretense of sort of military valour. And it was such a relief, if you were terrified, to be able to say so. And terrified you were. Well, I talk as if I was terrified all the time. I wasn't, most of the time. Nothing ever happens, even in the front line of a battle. Nothing ever happens. And every now and again something frightful happens. And what you're able to do at the age of 20, which was my age at the time, was to forget it in about an hour.
What about the men? What were they like?
Well, they were a sort of lot with two different origins. Many of them were heavy workers from the Durham district. Some were in fact miners who shouldn't have been allowed to enlist, but had got in by various subterfuges for the simple reason, I suppose, that they wanted to fight. And my own batman had been a boy in the mines in Durham. And what I know now, I didn't know then, they said he had his lungs troubled him, and he couldn't do a gunner's job because he couldn't lift big weights and things, so he looked after me. He was a delightful character, and he told me things about the life of Durham miners before the war that I found most interesting. And he lasted out. I don't think his life could have been long, because I know now that he probably had pneumoconiosis.
What was it? What were his duties as a batman?
Oh well, he used to try and delouse my uniform and my underclothes. He fought a brave battle against the lice. He never quite eliminated them. No, nobody ever got rid of lice in there. We only got rid of lice when we got to moving warfare again. He did all that. He used to take a candle and move it along the seams of my clothes, killing the lice eggs. However, he wasn't only a delouser, he used to cook my meals. which consisted when in the line usually of some broken army biscuits mixed with some woolly beef from a tin, mixed with some onions, probably bought by somebody on a visit to the behind the line. Used to make a most tasty meal.
What did he cook it on?
He cooked it in a mess tin. Of course, the woolly beef didn't need cooking. It came cooked out of the tin. It was really heated up.
Well, I mean, what sort of... He just would start a small fire, would he?
Oh, yes. They used to get hold of a little petrol, usually, to help with the fires. And a sandbag soaked in petrol will help.
What else would you have to eat? Or was that...
Well, at intervals, somebody used to go in with a motorcycle and sidecar and buy things in Poppering, usually, because that was our nearest town. So we weren't entirely dependent on rations.
What sort of things would he buy there?
Biscuits, other than army biscuits. Cake. Buns. Not often fruit. That was difficult. It didn't seem to be much. The one thing we simply couldn't get was fish. But food was pleasant.
Did you largely eat on your own then, or did you form?
Oh, very much. If you were at the battery or in billets, you would eat with together in a mess. You and the others would have this. But if you were on duty, probably your batman did your meals. That certainly was my experience.
How is the mess organised?
Well, I don't think it was really. It just came together. Chaps used to contribute anything they'd got, and we used to buy drink together, of course, splitting the cost.
You'd have a mess then, even when you were in the canal dugout.
Oh yes, yes.
Would that be in a larger dugout?
Usually there would be. If we're talking about the billets behind the line, there would probably be a dugout large enough to take half a dozen people. If you're at the battery, of course, there was the headquarters dugout where the battery commander's assistant, who was a gunner with a knowledge of primitive computation, used to work, and you'd have used it as a mess as well.
Would you have chairs and such like?
Not usually, not chairs. No, usually you'd sit on an old drum or oil drum or something. Not generally chairs. We made some beds out of odd timber. We used to have lots of chaps in the battery who could use their hands and used to do these things for us.
You mentioned you bought drink. Would you drink a lot, or would the mess drink a lot?
Well, we went a heavy drinking mess. The commanding officer drank very little. Our Canadian could soak it up, but I never remember him tight. And the rest of us could be tight when out of the line, but not in the line.
So you wouldn't drink much?
Not very much. I never did drink very much then or now. But you'd You take a whiskey and maybe a soda if you get soda.
So no one in the, none of the officers had a problem with alcohol?
Oh, not in my battery. It's they certainly had problems in some of the units. They would have some chap who would the difficult problem is the chap who can take an awful lot without falling over. He can be a menace because he think he's all right and he's not. But we certainly didn't have it. It wasn't a trouble of ours. I could tell you a trouble, thing about our brigade, which I don't think we'd better put this one in, because one of the batteries in our brigade at one time in the Salient was a battery with two long-range 6-inch guns, rather a rare weapon, which enormous range. And it was commanded by Lloyd George's son, Gwilym, a charming man. He was with an inexhaustible conversation. People used to pay calls on that battery simply to sit there and listen to Gwilym talking. But he was